Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, December 3rd, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And we've got a great show for you today. But before we get started, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that is because of support from listeners just like you. If you want to support the show, there are several ways to do it. You can go to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support, just like the patrons did this week, including Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil Tiber, The Zombie Drummer, David J. E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and dozens of others just like you. Thank you guys so very much. You can also shop for cool Talk Nerdy swag at talknerdymerch.com. I've got some new stuff in the store with Killer the Science Dog on it. So if you've ever wondered what Killer looks like, or you know what Killer looks like, and you just want to rock Killer on a hoodie or a t-shirt or a baby onesie or a tote bag or even a mug, you can check all of that out again at talknerdymerch.com. Okay, guys, I'm really excited about this week's episode because I get to chat with one of my good friends, and she's awesome. And if you haven't seen her show yet, I know you're going to fall in love. So she's the former host of Gross Science, which is a great YouTube channel that you have to check out. And now her show is called, I love this, Science Magic Show Hooray for the Washington Post. Without any further ado, guys, here she is, Anna Rothschild. Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure.
All right. So lots of changes lately. We're not going to talk about the fact that we've already recorded a whole episode but didn't use it because you changed your job. I'm really excited to talk about your new position. So you, we are connected via Tay Interwebs because I'm in Los Angeles and you're in Washington, D.C. And you're actually at the offices of the Washington Post?
I am. Yes, I'm here.
You're there. You're in the office. And do you work in the office every single day? Is this a big, weird change for you?
Yeah, it's super strange. I mean, it's actually really amazing to be able to like walk into the hallowed halls of the Washington Post and see all of these really incredible genius reporters at work. I feel very lucky to work here every day. It's a pretty magical experience.
It is magical. And I love the name of your new show. I love everything about your new show. The Washington Post's Science Magic Show. Hooray. But of course, it's all you. It's Anna Rothschild. So Anna, tell me about how, like what you're doing with your new series and also kind of what changes you've made, kind of what led you into doing it from when you were doing your old show, Gross Science.
Yeah. So when I started at the Washington Post, I wanted to create a show that had a sort of broader vision. And for a long time, I've really wanted to create sort of a science variety show, like a little bit in the style of Pee-wee's Playhouse, if you remember that show from when we were kids.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was a huge Pee-wee fan. And so I wanted to create a kind of magical world where we could talk about science stories from a few different angles and, you know, explore them at a macro level, at a micro level, all geared for like a kind of younger audience. And so, yeah, I built a set. And now I get to tell kind of longer form stories than I got to do with Gross Science. I still get to talk about lots of gross stuff on the show because I just am obsessed with gross things. So I can never veer too far from my heart. but yeah, the format allows me to explore stories from a few different angles. So for example, I have an episode on why do we have butts? And I get to talk about not only, you know, why our butt muscles, human butt muscles look the way they do, but why we actually have, for lack of a better term, a hole through which we poop that is separate from the hole through which we eat.
I love it.
And then I also even get to talk about when our butts kind of evolve when our butts develop, like when we're in the womb. So like I get to talk about it from a developmental biology perspective, from an evolution perspective, and then from just like a kind of mechanical, you know, how our muscles work perspective.
Oh, it's so great. And it features like a really good mix of sort of narrative, also interviews, clips, and like beautiful animations that all come together to tell this story. And of course, you have this really cool set that is, it is kind of reminiscent of Pee-wee's Playhouse a little bit. It's so fun.
Oh, thanks, Kara. Somebody actually gave me a little Pee-wee doll that's like in the corner. It's like a little kind of Easter egg.
Oh, I love that. And so wait, tell me, I don't know if this, is this a puppet friend named Gladys? Tell me about Gladys.
Oh my gosh, yes. Right. I never had made a puppet before, and I bought some felt and sewed a little puppet friend named Gladys, who speaks in a voice that is slightly reminiscent of my grandparents. I think she might be an insect of some sort, but I hope that my grandparents don't take that as some kind of diss. I really meant it as a compliment completely.
No, she's a very sweet insect. She's purple and red and has big cute googly eyes and orange antenna. And she's a bug, right? Because she has six legs.
She has Correct. Also plays the ukulele. Yeah.
That's amazing. Oh, man.
So, yeah, she's sort of like my co-host, I guess.
I love it. Have you always like kind of secretly deep down really wanted to do a sort of, I mean, I know you mentioned the excitement of doing a variety show that's kind of more geared towards kids. It's informational and entertaining and problem solving. But have you secretly kind of deep down always wanted to do it in this really big way?
Oh, for sure. I've actually had this idea floating around for a really long time. It's been years. And the fact that I got to start at the Washington Post and have my boss, Michelle, hear the idea and be like, oh, my goodness. No, we have to do this, was just the most amazing experience to have somebody sort of see my vision the same way I did and really just let me run with it. Yeah, it was really exciting to be able to bring this idea to life.
I am so excited to, like, looking at your first episode, I am so excited by the comments that you got. First of all, super cool to see your old colleagues from PBS commenting, from BrainCraft, of course, and from It's Okay to Be Smart, saying how excited they were, but also loving, like, all of these people. My favorite one. Wow, look at those high production values for a video about butts. This is amazing.
Yes.
It's so good. Oh my gosh. And of course it like features John Cena for like I don't know. It's like such a weird cameo in the best possible
way. It's so, like the funniest cameo. I know, I felt so lucky that he actually decided to ask the question. So great.
That's so awesome. And so tell me, like, is the idea here that you can reach children, but at the same time, knowing that probably a lot of their parents are watching, knowing that there are grown-up kids like me who would watch this even though I don't have kids?
Yes, 100%. So when I wanted to make a show that was accessible to children, I knew that I really wanted to make something where kids and parents, or just curious people anywhere, could watch it too. One of the sort of gaps, I think, in children's programming is stuff that kids and parents can really watch together, where the parents aren't like, oh my gosh, this again, you know?
Yeah.
And I wanted to make something that families could enjoy so that actually, like, the parents can end up being, like, the sort of ambassadors for science for their children. So my video just becomes a starting place. And then, you know, if a parent's watching with their kid, then they get to be on this adventure together. And then maybe the parent can help them dive deeper into the subject, you know?
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there are the viewers, just like the grown-up kids like we are, who are going to watch and just, you know, be like, this is awesome in its own right, that don't necessarily have children, you know?
Oh, heck yeah. And I mean, like you said before, you still kind of always are going to dip into your gross science roots and talk about things that are sort of maybe, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? A little taboo, or just a little like not what, you know, your grandma might have wanted you to talk about in polite company.
Oh, 100%. Ghost stuff is very important to me. And I think that it's like one of the biggest vehicles for curiosity. I 100% fell in love with science by doing like gross experiments in sixth grade. And that will never stop, no matter how old I get. So
yes,
I will never stop being gross.
What are some of the experiments that you remember doing?
Well, I actually, so first of all, my love of science probably really started when I was given this slime chemistry set. You know, slime's all the rage now, but I feel like I was like the slime OG, you know, making slime when I was in sixth grade, which was a long time ago at this point.
Yeah. Was it the same ingredients?
Oh, for sure. And there were like various different types of slime in this kit. It was a very, very good slime chemistry set. I wish I remembered the brand. it was great. And so that set me down a path. I was convinced that I wanted to be a biochemist because for some reason I got it in my head that biochemists made slime all day. I have no idea where that came from.
I love that. That's so funny.
But yeah, was convinced, like would tell everyone. but then like another experiment that I loved also in sixth grade was like a big kind of year for me was, in terms of like falling in love with science, was dissecting owl pellets.
Oh my gosh. I love that. Not only do I know what those are, I have a friend who somehow smuggled me an owl pellet kit and it's in my closet right now.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like saving it for a special occasion.
Like, I wish we could just do it together right now. We're like, we were in the same room. The rest of the podcast would just be us with tweezers, like picking through essentially like owl puke.
Yeah, just like making weird grunting sounds.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, totally.
That probably actually wouldn't be the best audio podcast.
It might not.
I bet you a lot of people haven't had the chance to partake or engage. Can you like maybe tell us a little bit about what you do in an owl pellet lab?
Yeah, for sure. So basically, owl pellets are like these mostly digested balls of matter that owls kind of like barf up. and inside of them contain all of like the indigestible parts of what they just ate. So if they ate a mouse, you can find almost an entire mouse skeleton within this little pellet. And you use tweezers to sort of pull the pellet apart, and then you can kind of reassemble the skeletons of the owl's prey, which is very gruesome and very fun.
Oh my gosh.
It gives you a sense of sort of like, you know, how our body or how at least how a mouse's body works or a vole's body, you know, like it gives you a sense of like, you know, skeletal biology, but also just like evolution. Like how did owls evolve to have this weird behavior? Anyway, love them. Very cool. I hope you all get the opportunity to dissect an owl pellet one day.
Yeah. And the truth is, if you live in a place where like there are barn owls, maybe living in barns, or you have access to a place where you know that owls hang out, you might be able to just find the pellets on the ground and then you can dissect them yourself. Like, I think that's how these labs get put together, is people just know where to go collect them, because it's basically, like you said, it's just a hairball. It's like fur and bones of the stuff that they ate, the stuff they can't digest. And then we get to play with it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yep. Oh man.
It's a prepackaged science experiment just like waiting for you.
Absolutely. I did my first owl pellet lab in college, which is so weird, but I was taking a paleontology class, and so there was like a comparative anatomy section where we compared like bird bones to dinosaur bones to human bones and other sort of mammal bones, and looked at the differences kind of where those precursor organisms sort of like split off and evolved. And so a big part of that was to like play around. I think it's just like the cheapest way to get your hands on bones.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But super effective.
Oh yeah, for sure. Okay. So we've been talking about owl pellets for like many, many minutes, which is fine.
Yeah, I know.
It's totally a normal thing. Yeah. But so you dip back into all of these gross things that make you, you know, that really are a first love and that you're super interested in. But I also love that the questions are very basic kind of why and how questions, you know, like why do cats purr? Why is blood red? And then like some sort of debunker kind of things like, you know, why do your veins look blue? And then you can actually get into some of the maybe misconceptions that people have about basic sort of biology or basic science that, you know, it's funny, we learn these things when you're young, but somehow we end up forgetting them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I really wanted to do with the show is to address topics that are overlooked, things that we might just take for granted, whether it's why is blood red or why we sweat, you know, or why cats purr. You know, I want to address topics that we're faced with every day, but that we don't even think about as questions. and to sort of help expose the kind of like wonder that's in front of us all the time. And very often we've been sort of given ideas about why a certain thing happens that, as you said, might just not be true. And it's fun to kind of dig a little bit deeper and get to a much broader picture of why something is true than what you might have just read on like a listicle on the internet, you know?
Oh my gosh, you're right. Isn't that how like most people are getting their news nowadays?
Yeah. You know.
But the cool thing is, it's still not like a huge commitment. You know, your videos are kind of between like 2 minutes and maybe 8 minutes. Like,
yeah,
you can sit down and you can learn a lot in a really kind of compact amount of time. And when it comes to, I mean, I'd love to talk a little bit about how the sausage gets made, because I have no idea if the people listening to this are going to find this interesting, but I do. So, but of course, I care. Yeah, right. I care so deeply about science communication, and you do as well. And you are such a brilliant practitioner of science communication that I would love to know a little bit about your process in terms of like, at what level do you want to make sure your information comes across? How do you know if you're being too technical or not technical enough? Like, where is that sweet spot for you?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. Second of all, I do far more research for each episode than makes it into any given episode. Mm-hmm. So usually I am talking to actual scientists working in the field of study that the video is about, and we will have a much broader conversation than ever makes it into the video. I sometimes feel bad because we'll have talked for half an hour and have had this kind of, you know, magical, like, deep dive into, you know, like, the mechanics of blood or something, and then I show them the video and it's, you know, like only a small fraction of that information has made it into the piece. But I want to make sure every single time that I understand like four times as much as I'm actually putting in the piece in the end. In part just to make sure that it's obviously accurate, but also because I get a lot of questions on the channel, and so I want to make sure that I have really good answers when people want to dig a little bit deeper.
Ah, and also you interview experts on these topics too. So obviously there's probably a lot of those interviews that, you know, have to end up on the cutting room floor.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like I did an interview. My last video was about naked mole rats, and it was one of the most they are fascinating animals.
Did you do this before or after the study came out about how like they eat their mother's poop to like... Do you remember this? This like just came out probably just a week ago. Wait, so I think that's newer.
No, I think I did it before.
Yeah, there's some new crazy study about naked mole rats and like, because your video is about how they pick their queen, right?
Yes.
Yes. So apparently, you know, because obviously you know this because you made a video about it, but they have something of a similar structure to like a beehive where there's like a hierarchy. But there's also some study. Yeah. Eating the queen's poop makes naked mole rats better parents.
What? Amazing.
I know, but it was just published on the 18th. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh. I need to go find it. That's incredible.
I know. Maybe you could do an addendum or something.
Yeah, exactly. Naked mole rat video part two. I mean, truly, I did interview this guy for an hour and the video is only like 7 minutes long. So,
well, yes, I could plenty more
absolutely
stuff.
Make, yeah, another naked mole rat video in a heartbeat. Would be delighted to.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. Just so that you know, and of course, nobody listening cares, I just chatted you a link to a write-up of that article.
Oh, awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay, so did people like lose their minds? Were they like, oh my gosh, naked mole rats are the crazy? I mean, first of all, they're amazing looking. And so just right there, it draws you in, right? There's something about a naked mole rat that's super alien. But then the fact that they have such a fascinating familial structure, I mean, it's like a wealth of information, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the more you learn about naked mole rats, the stranger they get. And one of the things that I think is really interesting about them is that people sort of like didn't study them for a long time. They just kind of assumed they knew what the deal was with naked mole rats. And then like, you know, it was only a few decades, like they had been discovered like long ago, but then it was only a few decades ago that people were like, oh my God, these things have the strangest social structures for a mammal. Their social structure looks much more like ants or bees, like you'd mentioned. But then on top of that, you know, They also can survive without oxygen for a really long time. They're like very resistant to cancer. They're these creatures that sort of break all of the rules. And in many ways, we didn't know about that just because they were kind of overlooked.
Yeah, because they live in the dirt.
Yeah, exactly. And
they're sort of like beneath our feet.
So attractive, you know? Like they're not like, they don't look like the most charismatic creatures, but they are in fact these kind of like mavericks, these mammal mavericks.
There is this kind of weird psychological phenomenon where there are things that are really, really cute. And I feel like obviously developmental and evolutionary psychologists and biologists have done a pretty good job coming up with good theories as to why, of course, we're attracted to things that are pedomorphic, things with neoteny, mm-hmm. right? Like things that look like babies, big yep. eyes, big bobbleheads, all that good stuff. So yeah, we know what's cute. Puppy dogs are cute. Bunny rabbits are cute, all that good stuff. And then there's this weird thing where like things get increasingly ugly. And then once they're ugly enough, they're weirdly cute again.
I know. Naked mole rats look like wrinkly sweet potatoes, but they are somehow really, really cute.
Yeah,
wrinkly sweet potatoes
crazy
with teeth and
and
tails.
Yeah, they're like little hairless hamster.
Yes, exactly. But somehow they've crossed back over into cuteness again.
It's true. Now all we need is like a Disney cartoon about them and we're set.
Yep, exactly.
Then they will have fully entered the zeitgeist, almost like tardigrades.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, I love tardigrades, but I digress. Okay, so I'm loving this. I'm just looking through some of your incredible episodes. It's fun that, you know, when did you actually first start working at the Washington Post? Do you remember like the first month or day?
I started there about a year ago now.
Okay, yeah. Cool. So it's been about a year. You had, you know, a few months of kind of like getting the lay of the land, getting the right producers together, doing pre-production, all that good stuff. And then you started launching videos pretty quickly after. But it's so cool that it's still early enough. It's like when a new show comes out and you find out about it kind of early that you're like, I can binge all the episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. We just started like in the spring, I guess. So yeah, there's enough episodes to binge on, but it's not like there's an entire whole, you know, 80 episode library yet.
Exactly. So. It's not at all mm-hmm. overwhelming. And we can really kind of like look through the breadth of what you've done so far to see the mm-hmm. sort of standard that you set. So, you know, we talked about why people have butts. We talked about why cats purr, why blood is red, but then separately, why veins look blue. And then, oh, I love this. Why am I so sweaty? Okay, I feel really connected to this. And I have to tell you, I recently had on the show a wonderful writer named Mara Altman. And by the way, I feel like you guys would get along really well. And she wrote a book called Gross Anatomy. And it was all Ooh. About, and anybody who's listening right now, yeah, go back, look at that book. She's a writer, like a very talented and established writer. And she was just wondering, like, why do I get hair on my chin and I'm super embarrassed now that I'm about to get married? And how do I break it to my fiance that like I have to go get my chin waxed? And also, why do all these other weird things happen with my body? And why do our private parts smell the way that they do? And so she set out to do this science book where she like asked a bunch of scientists all these questions and nobody wants to ask. And I felt like not only was this book really thoughtful and interesting, but it was also quite feministic and empowering. And mm-hmm. I feel like there's this level of what she did with her book, but also what you did first with Gross Science and now are doing with Science Magic Show, where learning about our bodies and learning about the things that we used to think were gross, but that we sort of had like a shame element to, and instead celebrating them and realizing like, yeah, we all do this. And like, it's kind of cool. I think it's really empowering for kids. I wish that more kids grew up with that sort of excitement about their bodies and about biology instead of shame and kind of, I don't know, like recoiling or ignoring it or trying not to learn about themselves because they're ashamed of it.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've always kind of thought is that I think that especially around puberty is when we developing a lot of shame about our bodies. Mm-hmm. And it's because all of these abnormal things are not abnormal, but all of these things are happening that seem abnormal to us just because they've never happened before, even though they're perfectly natural. And I think part of it is that these things that are happening to us, like we start growing hair in places and maybe, you know, some people get their periods and like all of, and we start sweating more and all of this stuff happens that, we associate with being gross. And I think that there's a fear, there's like a kind of conflation between these physical changes that are happening and like a sense of moral wrongness, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of is why that sort of shame sets in. We can't just, it's really hard to accept these physical changes as purely physical changes. We start to internalize them as somehow like morally wrong changes. And part of what I really want to do is help destigmatize these things. So when I made Gross Science, actually for Valentine's Day one year, I made what I called a not so gross episode on facts about periods to celebrate like half the population that, or like the, you know, hundreds of thousands of people with uteruses who would be having their period on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And the episode did really well. And I still to this day am getting emails and Facebook messages and Twitter messages from people who've seen the video who are worried that there's something wrong with their bodies. And it's just so sad to me that until this one YouTube video came out, these people didn't have an outlet to talk about this thing that happens like every month, you know? For many people.
And to many, many, many of us. And like, you know, this, you mentioned the changes that come up and the time of our lives when they come up and the fear that comes along with them and the shame that comes along with them. But it doesn't help that like that stuff has become sort of entrenched at the societal level. And that, of course, we could talk for hours, and I don't want to necessarily take it to this place, but we could talk for hours about, you know, the people who have been in power and like the kind of frustrations and the struggles with sort of a feminist perspective, not being a mainstream perspective or being othered. And of course, you know, just all of the experiences of individuals who, for whatever reason, whether it's like a puritanical reason, a religious reason, or even just like as you mentioned, like a fear response, have been, even when these things are new and they're exploring them and they're discovering them, to bring them up, it's considered, like I said before, not okay in polite society. And you're right. Like, sometimes I think these people, these kids, these young adults, even older adults, are finding something in YouTube, finding a sense of community and a sense of belonging and a sense of like, I don't want to use the word normalcy because they're not normal, but you know what I mean? Finding a sense of understanding there.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, on the one hand, it's sad to me that there weren't parents or doctors or teachers in their lives who could have helped educate them and make them feel like their bodies are okay. But at the same time, I'm delighted that I could be there to help them have that feeling, that my 5-minute YouTube video could allow somebody to go, oh, wait, this thing that happens to me, that happens to like everyone? That's normal?
Yeah.
Okay, great. You know, I'm glad that it could be me. Though I really wish that it were a conversation that were happening, you know, all over the place. So you don't have to turn to YouTube to get your, you know, to feel normal about periods.
Yeah. And also I feel like it's so worrisome that, like you said, there's not enough conversation amongst parents and friends and physicians and teachers, so that, you know, I have a friend who is in her late 30s and she only recently found out that her periods, for example, were actually not typical. They were much more painful and much longer and much heavier than the norm for somebody her age. And she had lived her entire life assuming this is what everybody was talking about. But because nobody really opened up and talked about it, she didn't realize that things were bad enough that she ultimately ended up, you know, having a procedure and is doing much better now because it was ultimately tied to some uterine issues. But how would she have ever known if she didn't have these conversations? That's a big part of why the stigmatization can actually be really dangerous for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, that's so many years of pain, so many years to go thinking that, you know, your pain wasn't worthy of speaking up.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is, like you said, somewhere around half the population at some point in their lives is going to be experiencing these issues. the vast majority of the population is pooping out of their butts, I think. Yes. For the most part, I think so. Pretty much everybody has veins. Pretty much everybody bleeds red. And these are things that are so universal, and they're actually just intrinsically fascinating to us, almost even when we're babies. And it's just amazing that even as teenagers or young adults, we still don't know the answers to these questions.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I'm really trying to do is to get people to think critically generally. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want there to be a topic that feels so taboo that you can't ask a basic question about it. So whether I'm talking about periods or I'm just talking about, you know, why cats purr, like any... Every question, you should at least be able to ask the question. And I think that when you're afraid to start asking a question, that's when we lose curiosity. That's when, you know, we feel like science isn't for us, or that we're not allowed to be like the analytical, inquisitive people that, you know, I would like to see in the world.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Songfinch. Now, I don't know if you guys remember, but I told you about Songfinch a few months ago, and I'm so excited that I get to share Songfinch with you once again. This is just the best gift you can think of. It's such a creative, unique way to celebrate any, you know, reason to give a gift. But the holidays are coming up, so what a perfect time. Let me tell you about it. It's a personalized gifting company that brings your stories and memories to life through, get this, one-of-a-kind radio quality songs. And I'm not even joking. I didn't believe it at first, but you have to hear it to believe it. So in just a second, I'm going to share with you the song that an incredible composer created just for me through Songfinch. But before I do, let me tell you, the personalized songs start at just $99. They're delivered within 7 days. There's a songwriting community of 350 plus professional musicians, and it's growing. And I'm going to give you a promo code here at the end for a personalized song from scratch. It is the best deal you can possibly imagine. Weddings, anniversaries, birthdays, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Valentine's Day, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, newborns, so many more things. I mean, you're just going to have to get creative with this one. So here we go. Just take a quick listen, because I think you're going to love it as much as I did.
They take shape of podcaster, actor, scientist, explorer. They take form of YouTuber, writer, presenter, and more. And when duty calls, they organize. Nerd Brigade, assemble. Grab your papers and your pencils. Share the wonder that is science with the world. Nerd Brigade, with the knowledge. Take it and do what's a solid. Share the excitement of science with the world.
Nerd Brigade, assemble. Okay. I know I'm not as good as the singer, but doesn't that song get so stuck in your head? Yes, I have a group of friends that we call the Nerd Brigade, and yes, we now have a theme song, and we love it. The composer on that song was Yoo-Soo Kim. He's absolutely talented, and there's so many composers just like him ready to make a one-of-a-kind unique song just for you. Your song lives on a personal URL called Your Story homepage, where you can listen and download the song, read the lyrics, learn about your songwriter, and even share your code. And guys, I'm giving you the opportunity for $20 off your personalized song from scratch. Today, you've just got to use the promo code NERDY. So go to songfinch.com right now and use the promo code NERDY for $20 off your personalized song from scratch. I also want to thank HelloFresh for their support of Talk Nerdy. Now, HelloFresh is a meal kit delivery service that shops, plans, and delivers step-by-step recipes and pre-measured ingredients. So all you've got to do is cook, eat, and enjoy. And there are three plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family. Each box is full of fresh, delicious ingredients, and dinners are super, super easy. And each week, there's even a 20-minute meal on the classic menu for when you really don't have more time than that, which is like always for me. I love HelloFresh because it makes dinner so much easier. And I'm not talking just the prep. I'm talking the planning, the thinking about it. You don't have to decide what to cook. HelloFresh does it for you. And you get to try new stuff all the time. There's a global eats option that brings authentic international dishes and flavors just to you, the home cook. You know, you're going to make stuff that you never thought to make before. It makes it really simple and convenient. The ingredients come pre-measured in these handy labeled meal kits. You know exactly which ingredients go with which recipe. There's a full color card. So easy. And there are so many benefits of subscribing. You can spend less time meal planning and grocery shopping each week. You'll get out of that recipe rut. And it's super easy to go online and manage your account. You can choose your delivery day to match your schedule and pause deliveries whenever you're on vacation. So guys, you've got to try it. I tried it. I love it. Super yummy recipes that I got to make. Like, oh gosh, I'm trying to remember all the good stuff that I made. There was, let me see, Korean beef bibimbap. Oh, I love bibimbap. I love Korean food. A fajita recipe, a chicken sausage orzotto, very Italian. All so yummy. So yeah, what are you waiting for? I have to ask, because now is the time to try HelloFresh. All you've got to do is go to HelloFresh.com/talknerdy60 and enter the offer code talknerdy60. You're going to get a total of $60 off. That's $20 off your first three boxes. Guys, this is like receiving six meals for free. So just go to HelloFresh.com/talknerdy60 and enter the offer code talknerdy60 for $20 off your first three boxes, $60 total. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I think you're right. You know, I think that that's actually a big causal reason why a lot of young girls actually end up leaving the science pipeline early on, is because not only does it get to a point where we're maybe embarrassed to ask certain questions, but it gets to a point where, you know, science is kind of hard. It's exciting and it's interesting, but at an academic level, once you're actually in school, it's sort of hard. And it's sort of hard for everybody. But there are gender differences in how we talk about what's difficult for us. And there are gender differences mm-hmm. in how comfortable we are asking questions, and stereotype threat and Dunning-Kruger effect. And ultimately, what we end up seeing is that girls are like, oh, this is hard, so maybe I'm not good at it, so maybe I shouldn't keep doing it. Whereas boys are like, this isn't hard, even though it is. I'm just going to push through. And then you see this massive gender divide. And that's problematic, right? Like, the thing is, we've known about this. Social psychologists have known about this for decades. Yet somehow it hasn't really worked its way into the understanding of teachers and administrators and educators and even science communicators.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at stats on YouTube, and I'm going to speak very generally here. I'm not speaking for every single YouTube channel about science. Mm-hmm. But I know that many YouTube channels that focus on science, if you look at the youngest demographic that's where the analytics are given to you, there's a pretty even 50-50 split of girls and boys mm-hmm. or, you know, women and men. And then as you get older, the number of women drops lower and lower. That's pretty typical for many educational channels. Yeah. And that's really sad. I mean, it shows that there's like, when we all start out, there's that same kind of hunger for information and that same, you know, drive to understand the world, understand our bodies, understand the cosmos. But something happens. There's a change. And you can even see it in something as silly as like the YouTube analytics.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's probably, especially for somebody like you who has access to these analytics, who is working, you know, for a great media outlet and who is slowly but surely developing sort of a protocol and a team around you, that you can actually take some of that information in and you can internalize it and you can utilize it when you make these videos, when you target to your audience and you decide, you know, what topics you want to cover. I mean, mm-hmm. how, I can only imagine, like, how do you choose what you want each new video to be about?
That's a really good question. And it honestly depends on, I mean, It happens in a bunch of different ways. mm-hmm. First of all, sometimes something will happen that Like, sometimes I'll just have a personal experience. Like, I'm very sweaty one day, and I really want to know why I'm so sweaty. But sometimes, honestly, I find story ideas by talking to a scientist, and they go, oh my goodness, wait, you know what would be great for your show? This work that my colleague's doing. And that's how I'll fall down, you know, another rabbit hole. Sometimes, you know, I'll just be reading the news and a question will pop up based on something salient that's happening just on the front page of Post or something. So those are all kind of ways that I find story ideas. In terms of actually kind of ordering them, I do try with this new series to, you know, give a bit of a diversity of topics. And so I've been, a lot of the stuff I've done so far is pretty like biology based, but as the show goes on, I really want to try to mix it up with more chemistry, more physics, and have each episode feel a little bit different. But biology is definitely like my kind of background, my comfort zone. So the first few episodes have definitely been more bio-focused.
And so what actually is your background? Like, did you study science in school? Did you ever study film production, editing, journalism? Like, because you have all these talents. You're not just, you know, reading a script that somebody else wrote for you. You're doing all of this research. You are deciding what's animated, what is monologue, and you're actually editing these things too, aren't you?
Yeah, and actually doing quite a bit of the animation as well.
Oh, so cool. Is this all just on the job training? Like, what have you actually, I guess, academically focused on?
Right. So I have a bachelor's in biology. And after college, I worked in a lab for a few years, actually at the American Museum of Natural History, which was pretty amazing.
It's so cool.
It was a really, really wonderful experience. At a certain point, though, I sort of just loved talking to everyone in my lab and finding out what they were working on, what science questions they were trying to answer. I liked kind of that aspect of my job a little bit more than I liked pipetting, though I realized that is, you know, there's nothing wrong with pipetting. It just wasn't what I wanted to be spending my life on. And I ended up kind of switching gears. So I ended up going to graduate school for science journalism. And learned a ton about writing and a little bit about video production while I was there. But I actually learned most of my video production on the job when I ended up getting a job on the digital team at Nova, the PBS science show. Yeah, I learned how to edit and animate mostly on the job. And frankly, by doing a lot of internet tutorials.
Well, that's so great. I mean, that's what YouTube really is all about, right? Not only can you make stuff and put it out on YouTube, you can learn how to make that stuff. It's very meta. But I have to say, I love that that's your path, because I, every day, and I'm sure that you experience this too, every day I'm fielding questions on social media or through like internet forums about how do you get started as a science communicator? How do you do the job that you do? Or I'm working in a lab right now and I'd like to be able to talk about my, you know, research a little bit more confidently. And so often, I think people assume that they can't get started until they've like got all this very sophisticated academic education. Like, oh, yo, you can't even bother to do that until some authoritative figure taught you how to do it with a textbook and a test at the end. But the truth of the matter is, so much of this isn't even taught in schools.
Exactly. I mean, I loved my graduate program and we did a little bit of video, but we did not do a ton of video production in graduate school. Like most of what I've learned on the job. I'll say that like understanding kind of journalistic ethics and, learning how to write like short scripts. Journalism school was hugely helpful. But for me, I mean, there are plenty of people out there who could understand all of that without going to journalism school if they just kind of practice and have good editors in their life who are helping guide them. For me, I felt like I really needed to take a little bit of time and work on my writing skills, but it's definitely not something that is required. There are plenty of people out there who become wonderful journalists who, definitely don't have that sort of background and training. And then the video stuff, I mean, the like hands-on education is so important. Even if you are going to school, like you just have to keep practicing.
Yeah. I mean, and there are science communicators and science journalists who were scientists who never went to J school. There are science communicators and science journalists who are journalists who went to J school but never took a science class. You know,
right.
Like there are so many different ways. And then there are people who don't have college degrees who are doing this, or there are people who studied something, you know, like business, who then made a big life shift. I mean, I think it's just really cool that there are so many opportunities right now, and there's such a need for people to tell great science stories and to do it in a really engaging way and get people excited. Because, I mean, gosh, another tangent we could go off on, but I'm not going to do that to you, because I know that there's probably, I don't know, some rules about what you can and can't say now that you work for the Washington Post. But yeah, this now more than ever, I think that this is a very important time to be having these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. And I mean, one thing I'll say based on this conversation is that, like, there are a million paths to get to be a good science communicator or a good communicator in any way. But really make sure, if you're first starting out, that you find good editors to help you along the way. Because yeah. I think there are a lot of, it's very easy to fall into bad habits, and having other people around who can critique your work critique your writing, but also kind of give you pointers about your ethics and how to fact check well. Like, that is hugely helpful. So no matter how you get there, just make sure that you have people in your life who are helping you, you know, produce the best quality work that you can. Does that make sense?
I think it absolutely makes sense. And like you said, especially when you're just starting out, because that's when you're developing these skills that are going to last you throughout your career. And also, mm-hmm. as we all know, I'm just saying this again because it's fresh in my mind, because I've literally just wrote a paper about it. But the Dunning-Kruger effect is real. And if you don't know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is, it's named for two researchers, David Dunning and Justin Kruger, who wrote a paper and since then have written several more. I think this paper was in 1999, where they did multiple studies to try and measure people's perceived competence on, like, different tasks. And time again, people who are new at something or who have a low level of competence because they're just starting out or because they're just in the bottom percentiles always overrepresent how good they are at things.
Right.
This is just what we do. We are not very good at knowing how good we are at things, because the same intrinsic skills that are necessary, like logic and reasoning, if we're struggling with those skills early on in something, we apply those same skills that we struggle with to our metacognition, to our assessment of ourselves, and then we end up being wildly off. And so, yeah, it's really important to get help and to have good teachers and to, you know, be humble and check yourselves and don't assume that just because you got a fancy new job or just because, you know, somebody watched your first episode that you are, you know, the expert and you the be all end all and you're perfect at your job. Like, there's, of course, yeah. always time to learn.
It's actually funny, like, the older I get and the longer I work in this field, the more I appreciate good editors, you know, and it's like, it's the best thing in the world when you have somebody who looks at your script or your article or whatever it is and goes, you know what, you can take out this and this. And by the way, did you really fact check that? Because you should look one more time, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just the best.
It's also really a blessing, because there are just so many outlets now that I'm not sure if I would consider them news, but maybe content outlets, where the funding is so abysmal and the staffing is so limited that people don't get the editing that they honestly require in order to be trustworthy and in order to mm-hmm. actually utilize those journalistic ethics that hopefully they hold on to. And I've heard so many horror stories of people first starting out and, like, not being edited at all and having to issue, like, so many retractions or apologize for mistakes that they made. And I can only imagine how difficult that must be.
I know. And I mean, on the one hand, it's like, everyone makes mistakes sometimes, but we should all really, you know, especially if you're working for a larger publication, like, there should be people around who you can rely on to help you make sure that what you're putting out there is the best it can possibly be.
Yeah. And of course, we're talking there on this side of the conversation. That's a bigger conversation about things like knowing what's real and what's not, being able to suss out fake news, having a good, you know, baloney detector. And of course, right. you know, there are certain organizations and outlets that are more trustworthy simply because they care more about those ethical things. And there are other outlets that are less trustworthy. And, you know, sometimes it's kind of up to you and it's up to crowdsourcing and it's up to having these kinds of conversations to determine what those outlets are. But it's very easy to fall into a trap where we live in an echo chamber and where we look at not very trustworthy sources to tell us what's going on in the world. And I think that can be really dangerous.
It's easy for the most seasoned journalist to even fall into these traps. I mean, seriously, every single year on April Fool's Day, like half of the journalists I know get fooled by something or another.
I know. It's like, why do people even work? Like the newspaper should just be blank on April Fool's Day.
I know. Yeah.
No, it's so true. And it's so, it's funny because we always talk about now more than ever. But the truth is, this has always been an issue. I think it's just coming to light more now. But
I know.
I mean, journalism is a profession that goes way back.
It can just travel faster. Yeah. It can travel faster than ever before. And more people can see it than ever before. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And there's an agenda now, of course. I mean, it's an election year. Like, those things are happening.
Right. There's a lot at play.
A lot. An awful lot. Okay. I'm just noticing because I'm looking at the banner on your YouTube page that it says, Anna's Science Magic Show, hooray, made in the basement of the Washington Post. Did they shove you in the basement? Why does it say that?
So in my initial animation, I wanted to create a world where, you know, my set, if we haven't really described it, but it kind of looks like plants are growing from the walls and there's something a little mysterious and dank about it, I guess. And I wanted to create kind of a mystical world. So in my vision, I am creating the show from the subterranean basement of the Washington Post. But don't worry, I haven't been shoved in a basement. It's mostly just part of the sort of fanciful world building that I'm trying to do.
Okay, so you do have a real office and every so often you get to see the sun.
Yes, I get to see the sunlight. Okay, don't worry about me.
That's very important. But I do kind of love that because, of course, I think for kids, you know, they hear the Washington Post and maybe they think that's like grown-up stuff or like that's politics and that's boring and that doesn't apply to me. And there is something kind of cool. I'm sure like, you know, it's a learning curve and it's about working through maybe preconceived notions. But there's something very cool about having this outlet that's associated with this incredible brand, right? And like that we all read every day and really trust and love, but that there's this amazing, like you said, like subterranean kind of beneath the surface, behind the scenes, magical creative science experiment that's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, it's kind of a metaphor for what scientists and journalists do anyway, like dig below the layers to find like a kind of awe-inspiring story. That's what I wanted my set to kind of evoke and what I want the show in general to bring to the viewer.
I love that so much. So, you know, I don't do a lot of on-camera internet-based stuff. Every so often I'll do a web series, but I don't have a YouTube channel. I never have. I used to be a regular guest on a handful of like big YouTube channels like The Young Turks, for example.
Yeah.
I would go on there a lot. And so I have some experience kind of with the YouTube world, but it's never been my number one. My number one has always been podcasting and also television. But what I found, and of course I was mostly going on political shows and more like science shows that are for adults, is that I really struggled with the feedback, with the vitriol, with some of the issues that kind of being a woman on a video recording on the internet had to deal with. You have a different demographic that you speak to. Of course, you have plenty of adults who watch your show. Of course, you have really invested parents, but also you're attracting a much younger demographic than any of the work that I ever did. And so I wonder, do you have the same experiences that, you know, we've all heard the horror stories from many, you know, female YouTubers? Do you get those same experiences? How do you cope with negativity on the internet? Do you have the opportunity to block or to delete certain comments? Because, of course, they can really sully the kind of warm comment thread that all these kids are curating. Like, how do you cope with that?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So first of all, yes, I get the same sort of trolling and hate that many women on the internet get. I would venture to say all women on the internet get.
So you are not protected because you do a kid's show.
No, definitely not. I mean, anyone can watch it, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I also, so let me actually start by talking about Gross Science. So when I made Gross Science, I got tons of hateful comments. What I'll say is that after, 2 years of making the show, 80 episodes, whatever, like I started to really not worry about the comments that were about how I looked or how my voice sounded or anything like that. Like, I could really get into a zen place about it and just go, oh, well, they didn't comment on the content. So I guess, like, they had to find something to hate on. So they decided to pick on how I look or how I talk, you know?
Oh, I'm just glad that
they liked the actual content enough to not comment on that.
Amazing. Oh, I love that. Whereas my approach has always been like, yeah, that's why I don't have video on my podcast.
Right.
Just like, then they can't comment on how I look because they can't see me.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think a lot of people feel that way. Like, why subject yourself to hate if you don't have to, you know? I really did manage to get into a very kind of like focused place about it and just let those roll off of me. That being said, when I started my new show and I was getting similar types of comments, man, it was like everything I had learned just like evaporated. And yeah, all of these like terrible middle school feelings came rushing back. Like, all these feelings that I had managed to really come to terms with. It's like the minute you're starting a new project and you have all of these insecurities anyway about like launching a new thing, every single comment started like hurting me. Like, it was like getting stabbed in the heart, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've released a few episodes and I feel more confident with my vision for the show, you know, I'm starting to get back to that place where when there's a gross comment about how I look or sound or whatever, I can just be like, all right, whatever. But did you like the video? Like, I feel like with any new project, you're gonna have to go through that same whole like evolution again.
It's so sad, but you're right. And it sucks that it happens at a time when, like you said, you're putting yourself out there and you're like super vulnerable. Like, when you're at your most vulnerable is when I think the first deluge of hate really comes in, because you're new and you have a new audience and they're like,
right,
who's
exactly
this? I will say mean things to her.
Right, precisely. I mean, the other thing that I'll say, like, and this is actually just advice to people who are like starting new channels or, you know, whatever you're doing on the internet, is that like one of the ways that I really found with Gross Science, at least, to kind of combat those hateful comments was to just really be active in the comments section. Like, people always say don't read the comments. I say do read the comments. Like, I would read, at least for the first few days after publishing a video, I would read every single comment for Gross Science. And I do that now too with Science Magic Show Hooray. Like, I read every comment that comes in and I try to really respond to basically every positive comment. Mm-hmm. So then I'm rewarding good behavior. And as that happens and more people feel like you're actually there and being like the adult in the room, then fewer people, A, will like comment gross things, but B, then your audience starts going, standing up for you and going, hey, don't say that about Anna. That's terrible. You know? And like, that's a really amazing thing.
Oh, it's so true. And you're building community at the same time, because
exactly,
of course they get the positive feedback of not only am I watching her, but she's here with me and she's listening to my, you know, recommendations or my suggestions or my questions and answering them. Like, I get to be a part of this experience. And you're so right, because eventually you don't have to self-police because they'll kind of police for you. But also there is something about even the most awful people on the internet, when they know you're actually responding, they feel like, oh, crap, I'm actually talking to a real person. And they sort of sometimes back off.
Yeah, it's really true. It's really true. Like, you know, you just have to remind people that you're a real person.
Yeah.
You're not just a robot on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, this content comes from somewhere. It comes from a person.
And it's true. Like, sometimes they just don't know how hurtful. I mean, they do. Like, they should know better. You know, their mamas didn't teach them no manners. But sometimes having that having that reminder that like what they said was hurtful actually works. I mean, not always. And, you know, I don't recommend that everybody, like, I wouldn't even respond. Like you said, I think you have a great tactic where you don't respond to the negativity at all. But
yeah, I just reward positivity.
Exactly, yeah.
Mostly.
But I've definitely, you know, had experiences before where people have reached out to me, like on, you know, my Facebook or my Instagram or whatever, and said something kind of cruel. And then either other people responded or I was like, hey, that's kind of like a hurtful thing. I worked really hard on that, you know, on that project. And then they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, I was having such a bad day. I shouldn't have taken it out on you. I can't believe I said that. You know, it's almost like they don't realize until, again, you engage in a conversation with them that you're human.
Right. And I think, I mean, I even find myself sometimes, you know, on Twitter, I'll see something that somebody said and my gut reaction, if like I dislike what they said, is to just jump in and like kind of just imagine like that Twitter user is a bot, not a real person who expressed an opinion. It's the easiest thing in the world when you're not making eye contact with somebody to just like not see them as a human. I know that's terrible, but I mean, everyone does it. Even creators on the internet like have those reactions too. And you just have to check yourself, you know?
So
it's important.
It's like,
yeah.
It's like the way that we are in an elevator with somebody is very different than the way that we are when we're in our own car and they cut us off on the freeway.
Exactly. Exactly.
So right. Maybe we can go more like elevator Kara and less like behind the wheel, horrible road rage Kara.
Precisely.
The world will be a better place. But that is tough, you know, because there's, you have a second layer where, for example, a political, you know, web series can have all the hate in the comments that it can amass, and people will argue until they're blue in the face and they'll feel like they accomplished something. And then there'll be like discourse and they'll be like, oh yeah, we raised the discourse. Whereas like, if you have a show where you're really appealing towards children and people use crude language or they say hurtful or hateful things in the comments, other kids are now reading that. And so how do you, like, can you police the comments? Can Washington Post go in and delete things that are, you know, kind of like abusive or so negative that they might be dangerous for like the young women and the young boys that are watching your show to read?
Yeah. So, I mean, as with like, you know, with any YouTube channel, you can make sure that there are certain words that don't appear on your channel and certain types of abuse that don't appear in the comments. I try to not go in there too much, but because I'm creating a show for kids, I also need to make sure that it's a safe space, that, you know, anyone who's on the site sees stuff on there, like it's not going to be something that their parents would be horrified them seeing. That being said, I you know, I try to be pretty diplomatic and be respectful that when people comment, as long as it's not something that's actually like abusive or vulgar, that that's their opinion. And, you know, I just try to handle it in as adult a way as possible and try to like, you know, model good adult behavior. But yeah, I want to make sure I just need to make sure though that the comments feel safe, that it doesn't feel like, you know, a kid who's browsing through the comments would see something that would be like horrifying or scandalizing.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Like, it's got to be safe first and foremost. But then beyond that, the good news is that the funny, witty, you know, complimentary, exciting comments are the ones that usually get upvoted and they rise to the top anyway. And the hateful, horrible ones either get downvoted or people ignore them and they're all the way at the bottom and nobody reads them anyways.
Yeah. I mean, one other thing I'll say is that the show's also on the YouTube Kids app.
Oh, cool.
So for parents who are concerned about like making sure that, you know, these videos are like shown in a very safe context, kids can watch on the YouTube Kids app. And then very soon the show is also going to be on Amazon as well.
Oh,
so
wow.
You'll be able to see it there.
Oh my gosh, that's so exciting. And isn't there also some sort of YouTube hack where it's like, is this the same thing as the Kids app? Is there something where it's like /education or /reference or something like that, where like basically things that have been vetted for teachers to play in their classroom can find them?
Oh, geez, I don't know, but that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I think there is something like that. And of course, I mean, this is not Anna saying this. This is Kara saying this as a non-YouTube expert. So maybe somebody who has a little more information about that can tell me about it. But I know that historically, a lot of the PBS series and, you know, just a lot of the more vetted educational series like the Hank Green series and things like that kind of exist in a place where parents can go, where they know it's like safe, just like parental controls on your television. Like, I think YouTube does have some sort of parental control that you can look into. And the great news is your show meets, you know, the standards that are required to be on a kids app. So, of course, anybody right. can watch it and feel really safe showing it in a classroom, which is so cool. I hope teachers are starting to do that more and more. And of course, parents can yeah. put their kids in front of it and know that whatever they're watching is going to be informative and educational, like, and exciting. And they won't be like, Timmy, what are you watching?
What have you just learned?
Which is quite good. Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Anna, so I've kept you for like way longer than I should because you're at work right now and I'm stealing you away from your actual work. But you know,
oh, no,
that
this is an absolute delight.
Yay! Oh, good. This has been so much fun for me. But you know that I always close my episodes by asking my guests the same two questions. And I'm super interested to hear your two questions because we haven't really ventured too much into some of these big picture places. So might take a little turn here at the end. Who knows? So I want you to think about the future, and I want you to think about it in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be, you know, the future of your life, your work, your family. It could be the future of, you know, humanity, the future of the nation, the future of the globe, the future of the cosmos. And I want you to think about, number one, let us know what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night. What is the thing that you're like legitimately concerned about? You know, you're sometimes bummed out about, and it's been hard for you to kind of, you know, to rally. And on the flip side of that, though, what is it that you are genuinely, like, honestly, not lip service, but genuinely optimistic about when you look to the future?
Those are both very good questions.
They're evil on-the-spot questions.
Yes. I think that the thing that I'm most worried about is something that probably a lot of people right now are worried about, and it's just how jaded many adults are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry that there is no sense of sort of inspiration, that people mm-hmm. aren't seeing like the beauty that's out there in the world. But on the flip side, I guess the thing that I'm most hopeful about is that I've been just talking to a lot of kids recently and like, yeah, just meeting with a lot of kids just because that's part of my job. Mm-hmm. And gosh, kids ask the best questions. And I'm so hopeful for the next generation. I just think like if we can get more kids to hold on to that curiosity for longer, like it's going to be fine. We don't have to worry about this jadedness that I see setting into like half the people I know.
Yeah, so really our job is to just not ruin them, right? Like they already are amazing. So let's not ruin them and the future will be really bright.
I know. I feel like that was a little bit of a cop-out, but yeah, exactly. We just need to make sure that they don't lose what they already have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was at an event at a library a few weeks ago and like all of these kids were just asking the best questions and they were so much better than like any adult event I've been to or moderated in the past year. And I was like just so excited and revved up by like how engaged these children were. And yeah, I'm hopeful for the future. I think that we have a really smart, curious group of kids coming up to take over the world.
I love that so much. Guys, it's Science Magic Show by Anna Rothschild and The Washington Post. And you should go to YouTube right now. You should subscribe first and foremost, and then you should binge watch all of the episodes that are out. Anna, where can people find you other than Science Magic Show? Are you more active on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, all of the above?
Yeah, I'm on all of those platforms. I'm on Twitter at Anna_Rothschild, and I'm on Instagram at @AnnaRothschild. So follow me. I would love to say hello.
Absolutely. Gosh, Anna, thank you so much for joining me. This was such a blast.
Oh, it's always so good to talk to you, Kara. Thank you so much for having me.
I know. I have to say my one bum is that like we did this remotely. So the next time I'm in D.C., I'm going to let you know I might actually be there soon and hopefully we can hang out again and maybe look at more narwhals.
Heck yeah. That sounds awesome.
Very cool. All right. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.